The name Auschwitz now represents the ultimate in German wartime cruelty towards the peoples that Hitler subjugated and terrorized. Confusingly, there were three Auschwitz camps operating at the same time. The original Auschwitz was a converted Polish army barracks. It housed Polish political prisoners, Soviet POWs, and what the Germans termed enemies of the state, including Jews, and contained a single gas chamber. But Auschwitz I soon became very overcrowded, so Reichsfuhrer SS Himmler authorized the construction of a vast new camp nearby that consisted of rows of wooden barracks, gas chambers and crematoria, designated Auschwitz II, and known by the SS as Birkenau. A railway line led into the vast enclosure through a large red brick gatehouse, through extensive perimeter fences that were carefully guarded by SS positioned in towers and patrolling the wire. Row upon row of wooden barrack huts stretched in all directions, the camp divided into sub-camps that were fenced off from each other. On the western extremity of the camp were four large crematoria buildings, their tall red brick chimneys poking over the tops of trees and hedges planted to shield the buildings from the rest of the camp. The third camp to carry the infamous name was Auschwitz III, known as Monowitz. This was another huge hutted enclosure to provide living quarters for the tens of thousands of slave labourers who worked in the equally vast IG Farben factory nearby. Inside Auschwitz-Birkenau labored the Sonderkommandos, groups of prisoners organized into day and night shifts under strict SS supervision. Their task was the disposal of the corpses of the gassing victims. The men who worked on the Sonderkommandos had been given no choice. They had simply been selected by the SS from the transport trains that arrived regularly at the camp bringing fresh victims for the Nazis. The system of selection was virtually the same as that conducted at the Aktion Reinhard camps at Sobibor and Treblinka too. The SS labelled the Sonderkommando staff Hilflinge, or helpers, or more formally Arbeitsjuden, meaning Jews for work. They had another name for them that summed up what these men were forced to do for the SS, Geheimtrager, bearers of secrets. Because of the nature of their tasks and what they knew of the German extermination program, the Sonderkommandos were kept in strict isolation from the rest of the camp population. By the summer of 1944, over 600 men were employed working at Crematoria 2, 3, 4 and 5 at Birkenau. Their grisly duties included shaving the hair off corpses, removing gold teeth, sorting personal possessions, burning the bodies in the crematoria ovens, and disposing of the bones and ashes. Most were Jews, but a few Soviet POWs were also employed on the Sonderkommandos. The SS deliberately kept the men who were selected to work as Sonderkommandos healthy and strong. They had to be, in order to perform their vital tasks, which included constant heavy manual labour. They lived in separate barracks from the rest of the slave labour at Birkenau, wore civilian clothes rather than the striped concentration camp uniforms, and could supplement their diet with food taken from those who were dispatched to the gas chambers. Relatively speaking, we lacked nothing. We had access to reasonable food, clothing and accommodations, said Greek Jew Josef Sakhar, who was aged 20. Yakov Silberberg, a Polish Jew who arrived at Auschwitz at the end of 1942, on his first day working on a Sonderkommando, he met Kapo Shlomo Kirschenbaum. Silberberg told Kirschenbaum that he couldn't survive and was contemplating suicide. Large numbers committed suicide when they realized what they would have to do, while others adjusted to the grisly work in the hope of surviving and bearing witness. Silberberg recounted, Kirschenbaum told me that he too felt the same way when he was sent to the Sonderkommando, but was able to adapt. He said that I too would be able to adapt. He gave me two stiff drinks. I fell asleep, and after waking the next day, I felt differently about it and did not kill myself. Sakhar, who had arrived at Auschwitz in April 1944, worked in Crematoria 2, in the room where arrivals were ordered to strip. He was asked why he didn't tell the people that they were going to be killed, and replied, "What would have been the point? They were totally defenceless. What was the point of frightening them for no good reason?" Many of the other prisoners in Auschwitz considered the Sonderkommandos to be beyond the pale, to be, in effect, collaborators with the Germans in the destruction of the Jews. But in reality, those men who were assigned to these work units had no choice in the matter. If they refused, they would have been executed, and the determination to survive, even for one more day, meant that most of these men submitted to SS demands. Unfortunately, the Germans had no intention of allowing the Sonderkommandos to bear witness to their crimes. Entire units were liquidated every few months and replaced with fresh workers for this express reason. Working for the Sonderkommandos did not ensure survival in Auschwitz. It merely deferred execution by a few weeks or months. This meant that the Sonderkommando leaders called for an uprising to be mounted as soon as possible. Due to the vast size of the Auschwitz complex of camps and factories, a resistance organization had soon flourished. It included not only Jews, but also Poles, political prisoners, and Soviet POWs. The organization was called the Auschwitz Struggle Group. The Jewish section of the organization had been established in 1942 by arrivals from Chernyakhov and Malava, led by Motek Bielewicz. The Jewish section agitated for a camp-wide revolt against the SS. The wider resistance organization demanded restraint and warned that an uprising under the prevailing conditions would induce the Germans to liquidate immediately all prisoners in both parts of Auschwitz. But the leaders of the Auschwitz Struggle Group acknowledged that for the Sonderkommandos working in the gas chambers and crematoria, time was a luxury that they did not have. Sooner, rather than later, the SS would liquidate them and bring in fresh prisoners. "We did not believe we would survive," said Sonderkommando Shlomo Dragon. Towards the end, it was clear that shipments were becoming smaller since there were no Jews left to kill. I was sure that the entire Jewish nation would be eradicated. Such sentiments expressed by the Sonderkommandos did not sway the Auschwitz Struggle Group. "We could not take part because what was for them the only hope of being saved was liable to be for the others an act of suicide," said Bruno Braun, one of the struggle group leaders. Austrian Ernst Burger, a member of the Auschwitz underground, was sent to talk to the Sonderkommando leadership. He tried to appease them, but the Sonderkommandos continued to demand action, while the struggle group called for restraint and patience. At the end of June 1944, the Jewish Sonderkommandos were moved from their barracks in the main camp to live on site at Crematoria 2, 3 and 4 in Auschwitz-Birkenau. Among them were 19 Red Army soldiers who had been transported from the concentration camp at Majdanek, and they incited the Jews to revolt. Among the Sonderkommandos, there had emerged several strong-willed leaders who were determined to destroy the crematoria and escape from Auschwitz. Regardless of the calls for caution and delay issued by the struggle group leadership, the Sonderkommando leadership decided to press on alone and plan a revolt. It was all they could do to try and change their dreadful fates. The main problem for the Sonderkommandos was that they possessed no weapons apart from work tools. The Sonderkommandos knew that for their planned revolt to stand any chance of success, they had to have arms and explosives. Birkenau, as well as being a place of death, was also a vast labor camp, holding many of those prisoners who had been selected to become slaves for the SS. In order to take advantage of this slave labor, German companies had established factories close to Auschwitz. One such was the Weichsel Union Metallwerke munitions factory that manufactured artillery shells for the German army. A considerable number of the slave workers were females who lived in the women's camp at Birkenau and were marched daily to the factory. In January 1944, two Jews from the men's camp, Israel Gutmann and Yehuda Laufer, made contact with a small group of women prisoners in the hope that they might smuggle materials out of the factory for the Sonderkommando insurrection planners. The women the men made contact with, principally a Polish Jew named Rosa Robota, worked in the area of Birkenau where victims' clothing was sorted. But these female Sonderkommandos shared the same accommodation as the female prisoners who slaved at the Weichsel Union Metallwerke, including a group of girls who worked in the powder room where black powder explosive was stored. Rosa Robota, aged 23, had been born into a middle-class family in Chernyakhov. She had been a passionate member of a socialist Zionist youth movement and later worked in the Polish underground. Deported to Auschwitz after the liquidation of the Czerniakow ghetto in 1942, Robota had been assigned to the Birkenau female Sonderkommando, working in the clothing depot adjacent to Crematoria III. She already knew Gutmann and Laufer from the ghetto, so she knew that she could trust them implicitly. Other brave women willingly joined the smuggling operations. Esther Weitschblum, aged 19, and her 14-year-old sister, Hannah, had arrived at Auschwitz in spring 1943. Assigned to the munitions factory, there the girls met Regina Seferstein and Ala Gertner, who had been passing small amounts of gunpowder to Robota concealed in their clothing. Robota then passed the powder on to Gutmann and Laufer, who carried it to the crematoria Sonderkommandos for manufacture into primitive hand grenades. Weitschblum and her sister joined Seferstein and Gertner. This smuggling operation continued for 8 months without the Germans finding out. The women risked instant death should their activities have been discovered. Robota lived for this act of resistance against the Germans. Her strong feelings were undoubtedly shared by all of the other women who were risking their lives alongside her. Ala Gertner came from a similarly comfortable middle-class background to Robota. Born in 1912 in Bedzin, Poland, in 1940 Gertner had been sent to Geppersdorf labor camp, part of a group of 177 camps organized by SS Oberfuhrer Albrecht Schmelt. He had 50,000 Jews laboring in this semi-private camp system, which included the original Oskar Schindler camp. Gertner, because she spoke fluent German, worked in the camp office at Geppersdorf. Though conditions were tough in the Schmelt camps, they were not of a level found in regular concentration camps. Gertner was actually allowed to return home in 1941 on completion of a period of service. She married, but sadly was deported to Auschwitz in August 1943. Gertner initially worked in the warehouses, sorting the belongings of the murdered. It was here that she became friendly with Robota. She was then assigned to the office in the munitions factory, and Gertner was able to recruit other women to the conspiracy, passing stolen gunpowder back to Robota. For the Jewish Sonderkommandos, efforts continued to gather or manufacture weapons for a putative uprising. The gunpowder was fashioned into primitive hand grenades by using empty sardine tins as cases, while knives and hatchets were also secretly manufactured. A small supply of handguns was smuggled through the wire into the camp courtesy of Polish partisans, but it remained a pitiful arsenal when compared with the firepower that the SS had available to counter any rebellion by the prisoners. The nearly 7,000 SS that worked at Auschwitz were all routinely armed, but there was also a special security detachment that had little to do with the guarding of prisoners. Its function was to act as a regular military force to crush any rebellion, and it was well armed with infantry weapons, transport and grenades. The Sonderkommando workers knew that this special fast reaction force would swiftly descend on any attempted insurrection, with lethal consequences for all concerned. Originally, the Auschwitz Resistance Organization had wanted to plan an action in coordination with Operation Tempest, the rising of the Polish Home Army against the German occupation forces, planned to commence in Warsaw on the 1st of August 1944. But the Home Army and the Polish government in exile in London sent a message to the resistance group in Auschwitz that urged that no revolt should take place unless the prisoners faced certain death. By prisoners, Warsaw and London meant all of the prisoners, and not just the Jewish Sonderkommandos. This meant that, to all intents and purposes, the Sonderkommandos had to go it alone. The SS had certainly got wind of something suspicious going on among the Sonderkommandos. In early August 1944, Oberkapo Jakob Kaminski, a Lithuanian who worked at Crematoria 1 and had managed to smuggle about 30 homemade grenades onto the premises, was summarily shot by 29-year-old SS Hauptscharführer Möll. One evening soon after, the Crematoria 1 Sonderkommando was hurriedly called to parade, where Möll informed them that Oberkapo Kaminski had been executed. Möll told the 200 Sonderkommandos that details of their secret organization were known to the German authorities, and that they were prepared to eliminate anyone they caught who was involved. A new Oberkapo was appointed, a German non-Jewish criminal brought in from Majdanek extermination camp. He abused the prisoners and was hated by them. With the Red Army nearing Krakow in Poland and the transports of Jews from Hungary gradually slowing down, the SS decided that the Sonderkommandos at Auschwitz were now too large and unwieldy to handle safely. It was decided to reduce their size by executing large numbers of them. A sudden order was given for a work party to clear out the hall of the disinfection station at Auschwitz I, the main camp. The building's windows were sealed up with bricks and plaster. 300 Birkenau Sonderkommandos were sent to this room and killed on the 29th of September. This action by the SS convinced the Sonderkommando leadership that they had to act quickly if they and the rest of them still living were not to join their comrades in death, even though the struggle group wanted to postpone any action until the Soviets were closer to the camp. Any further delay in taking action could be too late. Early on the morning of the 17th of October 1944, the struggle group sent an urgent message to the Sonderkommando leaders, warning them that they had heard that the Germans intended to liquidate a further large proportion of the crematoria workers shortly. A little later, the senior Sonderkommando man at Crematoria 4 was ordered by the SS to draw up lists for the evacuation of 300 men. Towards noon, SS Scharfuhrer Busch, SS Unterscharfuhrer Gorges and a small group of SS guards arrived in the yard in front of Crematoria 4. All the prisoners were ordered to form up in ranks, except for 14, who had already been sent away on other tasks. Busch carried a clipboard that contained the list of prisoners who would have to go over to a different commando, and beginning with the highest number, the SS man began reading down the list to the lowest number. Several prisoners, whose numbers appeared on the list, told the Sonderkommando leaders that they would resist the transfer. In hurried and muttered discussions, there were those who argued for immediate action, while others argued to refrain from independent or immediate action. But one prisoner decided to precipitate action, regardless of the views of many present. Once Busch finished reading, those prisoners who had been selected were ordered to stand on the opposite side of the yard. The rest of the prisoners were dismissed and sent back to work in Crematoria 4. At this point, a prisoner fell out of the evacuation group and walked purposefully up to Busch. There was a brief angry exchange before the prisoner, a young Polish Jew named Chaim Neuhoff, suddenly yelled out, "Hurrah!" the code word to launch the rebellion, reached into his pocket and pulled out a small hammer. A moment later, Neuhoff struck Busch, the other 300 prisoners hurling themselves at the startled SS using hammers and homemade hatchets, or even stones, to drive the terrified SS men back across the yard. But within a few moments, the wail of a klaxon sounded across the camp, and shortly afterwards, the SS security detachment piled out of its barracks into vehicles and started racing towards the scene of the trouble. The Auschwitz revolt had begun. Inside Crematoria 4, the other prisoners who had not been selected to die rose up against the handful of SS that oversaw them. Then the men of Sonderkommando 59B used some of their homemade sardine tin grenades to blow up the crematoria, which burst into flames. As acrid black smoke plumed into the blue sky above the wreck facility, some of the Sonderkommandos charged the perimeter fences in a desperate attempt to get clear of Birkenau, forcing their way through using homemade wire cutters and then running into the fields that surrounded the camp. Others stayed put and continued to fight the SS with their few firearms. At Crematoria 2, Sonderkommando 57B also rose in revolt. The Oberkapo at Crematoria 2, Karl Konvent, was another criminal who worked for the Germans, brutally enforcing their rigid discipline. He overheard some snatches of conversation as the Sonderkommando leaders quickly thrashed out a plan of attack, and he threatened to reveal them to the SS. But before he could do so, Konvent and an SS NCO were overpowered and thrown alive into the crematoria ovens, while the enraged prisoners beat another SS NCO to death. The screams of the burning SS men were heard in the surrounding areas because it was the first time that the crematoria received living human beings, not the gassed bodies, recalled Sonderkommando Reiso Gnupfel Mett. It was also the first time that the smoke which had always emerged only from the tall chimneys now enshrouded the entire crematorium building. Ramming their weapons, some of the Sonderkommandos opened fire on the surprised SS, while others headed for the electrified wire, cut their way through using insulated cutters, broke through the fence that separated them from the women's camp at sector B1B, and turned southwest towards one of Auschwitz's numerous subcamps located at Reiskow. The remaining SS guards, outnumbered many times over, fled from the rioting and shooting prisoners until heavy reinforcements could be sent to their assistance. Sonderkommando 58B at Crematoria 3 did not rise in revolt, and neither did 60B at Crematoria 5. Large numbers of well-armed SS arrived minutes later to secure both of these complexes, but before they did so, the resistance leaders managed to dispose of their smuggled explosives down the latrines. There was no fighting, the SS corralling the prisoners under armed guard while they hastily searched the facility for weapons and bombs. External camp security was in the hands of Sturmbannführer Arthur Plorin's guard battalion, a mix of SSTV and Waffen-SS troops that manned the camp watchtowers and patrolled the perimeter wire. These soldiers had very little contact with the prisoners on a day-to-day basis, but were the vital ace in the hole for the commandant. During an emergency, such as a prisoner revolt, companies from the guard battalion would be rapidly deployed inside the camp. They were equipped as if going into battle, with steel helmets, web equipment, infantry weapons, and stick grenades. The idea was to steamroll any revolt with maximum but carefully organized military violence, snuffing out Jewish resistance in a few minutes of bloody mayhem. At Reiskow, where many of the escaped Jews had fled, the SS blocked the further passage of the escapees from Sonderkommando 57B. Under heavy fire, they sought refuge inside a barn and prepared to defend themselves with their few small arms. But the SS had other ideas. They set the barn alight with flamethrowers and then shot the Sonderkommandos as they fled from the resulting conflagration. All were mercilessly killed. At Crematoria 2, large numbers of prisoners had failed to escape, and the SS shot them down. About 250 were killed, including most of the revolt's leaders. At Crematoria 4, SS overwhelmed Sonderkommando 59B. A firefighting unit formed from prisoners at Auschwitz 1 main camp arrived to deal with the massive conflagration, and they witnessed the SS kill the survivors of Sonderkommando 59B. Once the fire at Crematoria 4 was contained, the firefighting unit was sent to Reiskow to put out the burning barn, where the other members of 59B had perished. A sudden air raid alert meant that the SS had to call off efforts to locate a few Sonderkommando who had managed to slip through their net, but the bodies of the slain were gathered up and were all returned to Crematoria 4, where they were counted and attempts made to properly identify them. All remaining Sonderkommandos were also sent to Crematoria 4. Three SS NCOs had died during the revolt, Unterscharführers Rudolf Ehrler, Willy Fraser and Josef Purka, plus at least 12 more SSTV and Travniki Ukrainian guards wounded. Such was the fury of the camp leadership at the audacity of the resistors that a further 250 men were summarily shot in revenge. A speech was then made to the remaining Sonderkommandos, warning them of terrible consequences if they ever tried anything like this again, before they were dismissed and sent back to work in Crematoria 2, 3 and 5. Once the all-clear had sounded and the air raid alert was over, the SS launched patrols into the surrounding countryside, including tracker dogs, in an effort to find 12 members of the Crematoria 2 Sonderkommando who were still unaccounted for. These desperate prisoners had managed to cross the Vistula River, but exhaustion forced them to seek temporary refuge inside an empty building. The SS was soon upon them, and they were all killed, their bodies being brought back to the camp. Once the rebellion had been crushed, the Auschwitz Gestapo launched an immediate investigation. The Germans knew that the Sonderkommandos must have had help in obtaining the explosive materials used to destroy Crematoria 4. On the 10th of October, Ala Gärtner, Esther Weissblum, and Regina Seferstein were arrested in the women's camp and hauled off to Auschwitz I for interrogation. They were charged with stealing explosives and smuggling it to the Sonderkommandos. Later that same day, 14 of the surviving Sonderkommandos were also arrested and locked inside a bunker in Auschwitz I's notorious Block 11. The group included Yankil Handelsmann, one of the revolt's organizers, and five of the Soviet prisoners of war. They all died of deliberate starvation. At Birkenau, in spite of the revolt and damage to the killing facilities, the murders continued. On the 10th of October, 800 Romani men arrived from Buchenwald concentration camp, having been deemed surplus to requirements, and were immediately gassed. On the 11th and 14th of October, two transports arrived from Ravensbrück containing 217 Romani women and girls. They underwent a second selection where some were sent back to Ravensbrück. The remaining prisoners were all gassed. The Auschwitz Gestapo continued to hunt out conspirators who had been involved with the Sonderkommando uprising. Two more women, one of whom was Rosa Robota, were arrested in Birkenau's women's camp and brutally interrogated. They were charged with having had contact with the Sonderkommandos and of transporting explosives to them. The women were singled out for brutal execution as an example to the rest of the camp. On the 6th of January 1945, after enduring unspeakable brutality at the hands of the Gestapo, Gärtner, Robota, Seferstein, and Weissblum were hanged in the women's camp. Two were hanged for an evening roll call in the presence of male and female prisoners who were about to go on to the night shift at the Weichsel Union Metallwerke munitions factory. Two more were hanged after the return of the day shift. The executions were presided over by SS-Obersturmführer Hösler. Just 12 days after the women were executed, the Germans, in the face of the rapidly advancing Soviet Red Army, abandoned the Auschwitz complex. Some 58,000 prisoners were sent on a march into Germany, thousands perishing along the way. When the Red Army liberated Auschwitz on the 27th of January 1945, they discovered only 7,500 ill prisoners left alive, abandoned to their fates by the SS.